The following is an audio podcast from the Korea Society. The Korea Society, in 2007, celebrating 50 years of promoting greater awareness, understanding, and cooperation between the people of the United States and Korea. For more information on our programs, please visit our website at www.koreasociety.org. On July 25, 2005, the Korea Society hosted a lecture titled The Origins of Koreans and Their Culture with Mark Byington, a postdoctoral fellow in Korean studies at Harvard University. The lecture, which was given as part of the Korea Society's continuing education program for teachers, addressed the important early sources of Korean language, art, religion, and custom. This is part one of a two-part podcast that can be found at our website, www.koreasociety.org.
Well, the title of this lecture is Origins of Koreans and Their Culture, and in this, what I'm going to address is the question, where do Koreans and their culture come from? And of course, this is a question that's impossible to answer, least of all in an afternoon's lecture, but what I hope to do is to discuss some of what we think we know about where different elements of Korean culture came from, when they came about, what those influences were, and maybe say something about how they contributed to what we think of as Korean culture today. This is, of course, a loaded question also because it requires us to define to an extent what we mean by Korean. And this, of course, is an ethnic consideration and is entirely dependent on what you yourself feel means by Korean. Do we mean 20th century Koreans? Do we mean Koreans of 1,000 years ago, people who lived on the Korean Peninsula at any time in its history? And if this is so, then there is no Korean culture. It's something always changing. But I think that we do have some general sense, or we can have some general sense of Korean culture based on what we know of Korean history and what we can see in Korean society today. And that's what I'm going to talk about. And since I'm talking about origins, what I thought I would do is I am a historian, and so I find myself unable to pull myself out of a historian's chronological framework. So what I did is I looked at different elements of Korean culture through time, linearly. Maybe not the best way to do it, but what I did is I broke up this into four phases of Korean history based on major historical events or historical configurations that I think make sense because they allow us to look at different elements of Korean culture in a context that allows us to see the historical aspect as well as different elements of culture. And there are four of these. Let me begin first, however, by saying that when we want to look at Korean culture, there are two very general ways to look at it. And what I want to do is draw a kind of juxtaposition here between what I call the pre-modern view and the modern view. These are not necessarily mutually exclusive, and in fact, the pre-modern view strongly influences the modern view. The pre-modern view involves the origins of Koreans from the perspective of pre-modern understandings of history, how history unfolded. And this is mixed with myth and with political interests. Of course, we have this as well today. History is very often mixed with political interest. That's probably more the rule than the exception. But historians in pre-modern times were not really concerned with culture as the way we would understand it today. They had no idea what a nation was in the sense of a people. They may have had some rudimentary notions of we as a group of people, but nothing as nicely defined as what we think of as a nation or an ethnic group today. Now, these historians wrote histories that were centered on the king and his court, which was thought of as the focus and locus of history. It was the reason you wrote history, in fact. Not the people. In the 20th century, of course, people became the mainstream of history. These historians also emphasized a kind of continuity based on political legitimacy, where you have a sort of almost a genealogical series of states which rose and fell in succession, and this sort of mantle of legitimacy was seen as going from one to the next, so that you have this continuous flow of history, which is very conducive to an ethnic history in the modern age, because we can say this is the history of our people, because it's, we already have sort of an unbroken lineage, and you can very easily move this over to sort of an ethnic viewpoint and say that not only is this the political history of our nation, it's a view of our people. And I'll say more about this a little bit later. Now, views of culture in the pre-modern period, to the extent that they even existed, ran parallel necessarily to the courses of history writing. And, of course, culture was based on the king and his court, what, you know, the king's culture and the court's culture. And this was very often mixed in with notions of literacy being something that was associated with civilization. And our culture is... I'm not talking about the anthropologist notion of culture, where culture is basically all of those things that make up the material and non-material aspects of our society, including ways in which we deal with things that may influence the development of that society. Culture had a very specific meaning, more aligned towards art and high culture. Now, the modern view is a little different, and I think this is the one that's probably more we are more comfortable with, and this involves a more circumspect consideration of historical sources along with archaeological data. Put them together and see what we can surmise about the culture of the ancient past. And we can speak of culture in its material and non-material aspects. Archaeology gives us a good view of the material aspects, at least those that have managed to survive all the centuries and millennia. And we look at these material and non-material aspects as the sum total of society's characteristic makeup, including its artistic and its literary productions, also its way of perceiving and portraying itself, and also the particular devices that it uses in order to maintain itself. I believe that the modern view is in general, I say more accurate, something that we may feel better dealing with because it's more empirical. And it makes a little more sense to us, especially since it includes the entirety of a society, and not necessarily only the ruling elite. But I don't insist that this is the only way to view cultural formation, nor is it necessarily correct in all respects. And also, I want to point out that this pre-modern view does creep into the modern view of Korean history because it is a tradition. It had been around for so long that, especially in the Korean Peninsula and elsewhere in East Asia, people who attempt to do history are coming out of this historical tradition that focuses on the king and its court, and it's a little difficult to pull back from that. And in the early part of the 20th century, for the first time in Korea, you have historians who start looking at the people as the focus of history. And what we mean by culture is tweaked a little bit, I think. Let me start with the pre-modern view of Korean culture, and I'm going to be very brief with this because I think we want to move on to the modern view as quickly as possible. But the pre-modern view of Korean history and the culture recounts this this idea that Korea originated with a figure called Tangun. And in the handout, there is a two-page translation of a... basically, this is the original surviving account of Tangun that we have it from a book called the Sangun Yusa, which roughly translated means survival from the three kingdoms, which was written down and published in the 1280s, so long after Tangun, if he ever existed. But what this account tells us, it attempts to tell us that this figure of Tangun is basically the father of Korean civilization, Korean culture, Korean history, Korean everything. And in this very brief account, there are two historical works that are cited. One is called the Weishu, and the other one is just generally called the Old Record. Neither of these exist anymore, and all we have is the few characters that make up this account. But he starts off, I should say that the author of the Sangun Yusa is a monk named Irion, who was attempting to rescue some of what he saw as being essentially Korean aspects of culture and history, which had been neglected by the compilation, the Confucian history that was compiled a century earlier, in 1145, actually, which, again, we heard in this morning's lecture that all of these old historical texts had been collated and then sanitized so that it looked very Confucian. But even a century after this happened in the 1280s, a lot of these old non-Confucian accounts were in circulation, and this monk Idion made it his business to collect them, trying to save them, because he was a Buddhist monk, and he probably didn't care to have his society depicted only as Confucian. But in any case, this is what he came up with, and what we have is a book called Weishu, which appears to be a Chinese book, no longer surviving, which says some 2,000 years ago there was a figure called Tangun Wangun, who established a capital at Asadal, and he called the state Chosun. And this was at the time of Emperor Yao, who was a mythical emperor who lived somewhere in the 2000s BC, supposedly. Then he moves to an old record, which appears to be a Korean record, that talks about this heavenly spirit, Huanin, who had a son called Huanung, who wanted to go down to the world of human beings. And his father sent him down there with a divine retinue, and he brought order to the world. And there is some description about how he did that. But this moves very quickly on to another tale of a bear and a tiger living in a cave who both wanted to become humans. And so they prayed to Huanung for this, and Huanung's spirit told them, he gave them some mugwort and garlic and said, eat these and see if you can stand not to look at the sunlight for 100 days. And then if you can do that, then you'll become human. And after 21 days, the bear managed to observe these restrictions and became a woman, and the tiger wasn't able to put up with that and stayed a tiger. And then the bear woman wanted somebody to marry and apparently didn't have a bear man around, and so Huanung transformed himself into human form, got her pregnant, and she had a boy whose name was Tangun Wangun. And the year given for this event is corresponds to 2333 B.C., very early. And then it goes on to say that Tangun made his capital at the city of Pyongyang, which is today's Pyongyang in North Korea. He was later booted aside by another figure, and then it is said that he came back in secret and became a mountain spirit. And then he died finally at the age of 1,908 years. And now this is basically the core of something that was elaborated on in some detail in the following centuries. Now, whether there are any earlier sources that had survived and were rediscovered is difficult to say. Even in the early 20th century, people claimed to have discovered these lost texts which told the whole story of Tangun. Maybe they're genuine texts, but more likely or not, they're apocryphal. But in any case, in later historical writing, Tangun became seen as a historical figure. Moreover, he became seen as a progenitor of the Korean people. But there is sort of a genealogical progression of states that is given to describe this instead of actual people. It's said that Tangun created the state of Chosun. From the state of Chosun came the state of Puyo and all of these other people, and then from Puyo came Koguryo and Baekje and so on down the line. And we have this unbroken lineage of states. Now, in the early part of the 20th century, nationalism also crept into this with the idea of the nation as a sort of a solid ethnic group. And Tangun was taught as the historical progenitor of the Korean nation, the Korean Minjok people. And there is a historian by the name of Shin Chae-ho, who was very prolific in writing about this topic and very influential. And he looked at Korean history as being something very, very grand, but at the same time lost. All of these, he tried to recover the lost part of early Korean history, which he saw as being something very grand and something that the people should be proud of on and proud about, but also something which should cause the people to come together into a cohesive whole. And shortly after Shin Chae-ho was writing his history, a native religion, a new religion, popped up called Taejong-gyo, which is something like the teaching of the great ancestor, which basically focused on Tangun and talks about a unbroken succession of states and peoples that descended from him. And now this view, the Korean nation is depicted as an essentially unchanging identity that has existed since 2333 BC, so a very long time. Now, some historians in Korea today tend toward this kind of view of history, while others who actually make up the mainstream are much more cautious about this and say that this is probably not historical. Nevertheless, the historical pre-modern view does have a way of creeping into modern discourse. Now, I'm going to move very quickly on to the modern view. For the sake of convenience, I have divided this chronologically into four phases. Now, the first phase involves prehistoric origins, which we use the archaeological record to shed light on. And this is characterized by increasing social complexity. We see the rise of chiefdom societies and increasing development towards more and more complex forms of society, and also increased interaction with neighboring peoples in a slightly later period. The second phase lasts from the late Bronze Age up until, which is about the 3rd century BC, up until the 4th century AD. And this is characterized by the rise of the earliest indigenous states on the Korean Peninsula and also adjacent areas in Manchuria. And then the third phase goes from the 4th century on until the middle of the 7th century. And what this is the Three Kingdoms period proper. Now, sometimes when people talk about the Three Kingdoms period, they say 1st century BC until 7th century. But in reality, two of those three kingdoms did not become kingdoms until about the 4th century AD. So it doesn't make sense to speak of the Three Kingdoms period until about that time. And then the fourth phase deals with what is called the Unified Silla period, which is roughly from, about from 668 until the 10th century when Silla fell. And I'm not going to say a whole lot about that, but I will discuss it in to some extent. Now, I'm going to go through these phase by phase, and I think that about halfway through we're going to need a break because there's a lot of material I'm going to cover. And if anybody has any questions, please just, let me know, wave at me or throw something in my direction if I don't look up, and I'll be happy to answer that because I want to make sure that, since I am trying to impart my understanding of Korean culture and its origins, I want to make sure that you pick up on that. If I have failed in my delivery, then maybe by asking specific questions, we can fill in whatever gaps I leave. The first phase involves the prehistoric origins of societies that we see not only in the Korean Peninsula, which is here, separated by the Yalu and Tumen River border that we have today, but also the adjacent region in Manchuria, southern Manchuria, which is now northeast China. But many of the elements of Korean culture, and in fact some of the Korean states in the early period, happen here in Manchuria. This period is characterized by, like I said before, increasing social complexity, which we do observe in the archaeological record. And we do see the first appearance of chiefdoms, which appear to come out of tribes, which are clan-based, small-scale groupings of people, and whereas the chiefdom may encompass multiple tribes and probably extends over, say, a single river valley, probably not much more than that at this period in this place. And also increased interaction with neighboring states and peoples, which goes hand-in-hand with rapid development towards more and more complex forms of society, sometimes culminating in the formation of a state, which I will say more about in a moment. But studies of the origins of Korean culture and history typically begin with the earliest archaeologically attested traces of human occupation on the Korean Peninsula. But it's difficult to know how these earliest inhabitants of the peninsula relate to anything that we would now think of as Korean. Nevertheless, it is customary to mention the Paleolithic and Neolithic remains, which are essentially ceramic, remains, pottery, that are found throughout the peninsula and discuss their development and their change. So I will say a little bit about the Paleolithic. Not much more than the fact that humans did indeed exist on the peninsula from at least as early as 50,000 years ago, and probably substantially earlier than that. The jury is still out on the question of does it really date back half a million years. It probably does, but it hasn't been determined with, it has not been conclusively shown yet. And also, like other Paleolithic societies, the people subsisted on hunting and gathering and fishing for their economy. From about 4000 BC, we find the first traces of Neolithic settlements on the peninsula, and this, of course, comes with the beginnings of agricultural production. And let me start with a slide here. You've probably seen this before. Early pottery types featured this kind of plain, conical, coarse clay vessel. It has a pointed but rounded bottom. This was probably sunk into a pit of some sort where an oven was possibly placed below it. And because these are decorated with lines like this that look like they might have been made by a comb or a fishbone, these are usually called comb pattern vessels. And these are found throughout the peninsula. I mean, they aren't found in all places of the peninsula. They're found in certain areas in all regions of the peninsula, usually around the coasts or major river valleys. And they're also found in the adjacent regions in Manchuria as well. And then finally, around 2000 BC, there is a new ceramic type that becomes dominant, and this features geometric patterns, a little more complex than that. Some of them tend to be almost like squared spirals, and there are various theories on the meaning of the different types of decoration, which I won't go into any detail. But settlements at this time concentrated again on the lowland coast or in river valleys. They didn't go much into the inland or upland areas. Now, Korean scholarship tends to look at these different types of vessels, which persist over many centuries or sometimes even millennia, and then are replaced by a different type. And people are very tempted to look at these as migrations. That well, these are just different people who came in carrying a different kind of pot. And they either pushed out or assimilated the people who were there before. That doesn't have to be the case. There's also cultural diffusion, which is a possibility. It might be the idea of the pot. It could be that maybe this is a better pot, and so people just start to use it. It doesn't mean that there was any kind of population migration. It doesn't mean there wasn't, but there are many different ways of thinking about this. But in Korean scholarship, I think still you tend to see the migration hypothesis more than not. Now, that's not very good, is it? Well, I'm sorry you can't see that very clearly, but sometime around 1500 BC, there's another pottery type that does begin to appear and become dominant on the peninsula, and this is typified by a kind of a coarse plainware, which you see a few examples of here, and this is called mumun pottery, which simply means undecorated pottery. And there is a very wide variety of types and shapes of this vessel, and you see a few of them here. And some scholars speak of the culture associated with these pots as a Bronze Age culture, which is a little bit misleading because you don't actually see bronze in the sites that produced these pots until much later, around 800 BC. And there's no real evidence or any real reason to think that there's any correlation with the coming of these pots and the coming of bronze. They were probably two entirely different things. But nevertheless, when people discuss the Bronze Age in Korea, sometimes they talk about the time when bronze actually appears and persists in the peninsula, and other times they're talking about the culture that produced this form of pottery. Also, at about the same time that these appears, we begin for the first time to see burials in stone cysts. And I wish I had a slide of a stone cyst. I don't have one, but basically what it is you dig a pit about the size of, say, a modern grave, and then you line the inside of this pit with flat stones so that it's sort of like paving the walls and sometimes the bottom of this, and it makes sort of a cyst in the earth, and then you would put the body in there. In later periods, they did have a wooden coffin, but in early times, they just put the body in there, and they laid slabs over the top and then put earth on it and sometimes raised a mound, sometimes not. But for the first time, we start to see this kind of burial. And this is followed by the appearance of these megalithic dolmen, which you also saw this morning, a a nice photograph of one of these dolmen burials, which seems to appear at about the same time as we see the stone cist burials. It is thought that these dolmens simply represent the upper crust of this society. Not everybody could be buried in a dolmen. And, of course, this does suggest an increase in social complexity. Again, if people can be called upon and organized to build these huge monuments, then somebody has the authority to cause people to do that, which indicates a fairly high level of complexity within that society. Now, bronze types found on the Korean Peninsula are widely varied in their style and origin. These are not all bronzes, only this one is. And by the way, this is the sort of thing that you might find inside one of those dolmen burials. In fact, I believe that these were found inside a dolmen. And you can see here the jade, the curved jades that we heard about this morning, and some other jade tubes or jadeite tubes, and a stone. These are made out of polished stone. And you have the one bronze dagger. And what I wanted to say was that there are certain types of bronzes that did enter the peninsula from Manchuria. Yes, go ahead.
Is jade the left arm?
We don't know what they were used for, but these were apparently something akin to religious and value. You only find them in very elite burials and in elite contexts, typically, and later on, you find them in the crowns, the gold crowns, and these appear in Japan as well, and they're one of the sacred emblems. We don't know exactly what they were. Today, they might be good luck charms. I have one. It never brought me any good luck, as far as I know, but there's no indication that they were used as talismans or anything like that. I think they were viewed as something sacred. But I don't know that this came in from Manchuria. There may be some... They do have carved jades here, but they tend to be straight. They're not curved. I've never seen a curved one in Manchuria, which is where I did my field work, so I think I would have seen them if they existed. But one of the items that does come in from Manchuria is this dagger, which is called a Liaoning dagger by some scholars because its origins are thought to lie in the Liaoning province area of northeastern China, which is western Manchuria. And I think the earliest ones date from about 800 BC in Manchuria, roughly give or take a century or two. And they do appear throughout the Korean Peninsula as well. And they even extend to Japan. I think some of them have been found in the western parts of Japan. And now this dagger is part of something which was brought up this morning. Professor Best mentioned this sort of northern... I'm going to say northern zone because that's what archaeologists in China call it. A certain type of society, a certain type of bronze inventory that is found that stretches across a very wide swath to the north of China, I think even north of Mongolia. But these do appear even in the northern part of China, but only in the very northern part. And this is one element of that. But this type of it's a two-piece dagger. There was a handle probably made of wood that went along with this. When you go a little farther over to the west in China, you find something similar, but it has a handle that is molded on with it, and this is called the Ordos knife. We saw the Ordos region in the hoop of the Yellow River this morning. But even though there are these differences, archaeologists and historians tend to speak of them as all bearing certain similarities such that they feel comfortable talking of them as elements of a northern zone of culture, which is thought to be nomadic. You see these bronze plaques with the animal motifs on them, and this stretches across the northern part of Asia, and it terminates. Let me show you the map again. It terminates right about here, and you stop seeing them around. This is the Liao River. Is it? Yeah, this is the Liao River right here. And you don't see it much past this area, but certain elements of it do trickle down a little farther to the east. And one of these elements is the bronze dagger, and another one are these little bronze buttons, which I don't have a slide of, but they're little tiny buttons. They were probably just put on clothing. Oh, there's also this mirror, which we saw one form of today. The one that Professor Best showed was a Chinese mirror from a slightly later time. These actually do occur in Manchurian context and in Korean context long before they appeared in China. That certain type did not appear in China until later. You can't see much detail on these slides. I apologize for that, but there is this kind of bronze mirror, which is, again, it's one of the sides was polished so that you could see yourself, and the other side is decorated. Now, what makes these distinct is that Chinese mirrors have a single loop on the decorated side for, you put your silk cord through there. The Korean models always have two, or almost always have two. You never see that in China. Also, the backs are decorated with these sometimes coarse and sometimes fine lines. Here you can see these are very fine lines. Here you can sort of maybe catch the reflection of some of those towards the top. This is very skilled workmanship. Somebody really knew how to cast these at the time. And these are found in the Korean Peninsula, and they seem to have been influenced by Manchurian predecessors. Oh, goodness. In addition, there are also some bronze items, mostly decorative, that are found only on the Korean Peninsula. We don't see anything really like this in China. These include things like finial caps, rattles. These three are rattles. I don't know what these were. Some sort of decorative items. And these are all from the Bronze Age in Korea, the first few centuries B.C. I should say the last few centuries B.C., say from the 4th century, probably up until the 1st century B.C. And these probably were used for religious purposes. At least that's what is usually assumed. Again, shamanism is the word that creeps in. As Professor Best said, it's an inadequate term to describe what we think we see in the Korean Peninsula, but at least at this in this time period. But nevertheless, there is this idea that animism and a sort of a figure who can serve as a conduit between natural and supernatural forces in the world of man is involved in this. And it's usually assumed that these just were attached to a shaman's clothes. They're held by the shaman who would rattle them and maybe summon the spirits in this way. We don't know. This is a good guess. Maybe so, but there are other possibilities as well. Other bronzes that we see are these curious things. We're not really sure what they are. They probably were attached to clothing. I think this is called armor for the shoulder. I'm not sure about that. I rather doubt it. But these are very finely cast pieces. And one of them, I think this, you can barely see it. There's some detail right here, and there is an impressed cast into the bronze, a figure of a deer, even with spots on the body. This is usually interpreted as indicating totemism, maybe not. But you can recall the deer. This was found on the southern part of the peninsula, by the way, and you remember the deer antlers that are seen in some of the Shilla crowns of a later period. Maybe there's a connection, maybe not. Another one is this shield-shaped bronze right here has a figure of somebody plowing. You can see these lines are sort of a stylized representation of plowed fields. So you can see agriculture depicted in the artwork on these bronzes. Now, remains like this, I think, indicate a developing society that is moving gradually towards what we might call a chiefdom level of social organization, which I mentioned before. And there were contacts with societies in southern Manchuria. These were probably short-range contacts, very small scale. And there was also a great deal of variety among the Bronze Age communities of the peninsula, and no indication that they were all linked together by some kind of a complex communications network. I suspect that there were probably clusters of communities occupying major drainage systems, and that they communicated with their immediate neighbors, but did not have more long-range communications with groups farther away. And this brings us to the late phase of the Bronze Period, roughly the 3rd century B.C., and this is a very critical time in the history of the peninsula because the course of social development of the northwestern part of the peninsula and the southwestern part of Manchuria, roughly this area right here, was preempted by a political event. And I'm going to say more about this. I have a lecture tomorrow morning about Korean history, per se, and I'm going to say more about it at that time, more detail. But I will say that due to a military expansion, roughly around 280 BC, a Chinese state called Yan, Y-A-N, sometimes written Y-E-N in a different way of transcribing Chinese, which was based at modern Beijing, which would have been about here on the map if it extended that far. For the first time, the state of Yan came into direct contact with peoples living on the Korean Peninsula by expanding into this area here and occupying the Liaodong Peninsula. This has become this will become a very critical region for how the way political history would later develop on the Korean Peninsula. So remember the Liaodong Peninsula. Some of the societies in southern Manchuria at this time were just assimilated wholesale into the system of territorial administration that the state of Yan had set up. Everybody who was living here, they were simply forced into a state level of complexity, which may not have meant very much at the village level, but it did affect the shape and course of development of their societies in a very profound way. And after a few generations, they had pretty much lost their previous identity and had become something sort of a hybrid between what they had once been in and what they had been forced to take in from the Chinese state of Yan. And we see this in the archaeological record happening very gradually. Just beyond the sphere of Yan control, and Yan control actually extended around this, probably took the northwestern tip of the Korean Peninsula. There is actually a wall here that probably was built by Yan or built against Yan. But just beyond that, that sphere of control, the indigenous cultures of this area were preserved. They continued to exist independent of this. But certain elements of this advanced Yan culture did begin to trickle in to those societies, and this affected their rate and direction of social development. For one thing, iron farming tools start to appear from this period, and we see that a certain type of iron farming tool, hoes and plowshares, appearing in archaeological context around here. And then very shortly afterwards, we start finding them here and here and here. And these probably are being traded outwards. And these are very good things. If you're a farmer, you would really like to have an iron plowshare because it sure beats wood. It's not going to break as often. Iron's very rugged. And this has the effect of making agriculture much more productive, which is one of the things you want to have if you are going to develop into a state. And then a little bit later, maybe a century or two later, you start to see iron in the form of weapons appear as well. And this, you see not only weapons, but even armor. And when I say weapons and armor, I don't mean Chinese style. These are not Chinese-made pieces that are simply being exported. What this indicates is that people in this area have learned iron technology. They know how to cast iron, and then they start making weapons and armor. And if there is any kind of influence from the outside in this area, right here in Manchuria, it's not really coming from China, at least in the form of weaponry and armor that we see. It's probably coming from these nomadic groups farther to the north. I'll say more about that later. Also, another big thing is the horse appears for the first time in this area. We don't see the horse at all in this area for many, many centuries. And finally, around third century BC, suddenly we see the horse appear in a very big way here, and not only being treated as a good thing to have if you want to go to war, but also it's found in ritual context. I'm going to talk about the state of Puyo a little later, but Puyo cemeteries have this interesting characteristic in that in the center of the cemetery there's a pit with a horse skull in it. Evidently there is some sort of a ritual association with the horse at this time. And as I said, the weaponry and the horses do facilitate or they promote mounted warfare, which is another one of those things that you want to have if you're going to become a state. Not that you're planning to become a state, but it certainly accelerates your progress towards that. And the first states actually did emerge out of these developments. And now, before I start discussing these earliest states and their cultures, let me see what my next... I'm going to go to Puyo in a minute. But now, before I start talking about these first states, I want to mention very briefly that the traditional view of Korean history that I mentioned earlier maintains that there was a state called Joseon, sometimes called Old Joseon, that had already long been in existence by the time that Yan expanded eastwards around 280 BC. It's thought that maybe Old Joseon was located here, and then when Yan expanded, it kind of moved back in this direction. But historical records are not conclusive with regard to the early existence of Joseon, and so far archaeological evidence has not substantiated it. We look for it, but we can't quite find it. Now, many Korean scholars believe that this old Joseon state existed at this early time, say 3rd century BC. I believe that a more tentative approach is probably called for because we simply lack conclusive evidence. And conclusive evidence, by the way, is not likely to come from North Korea anytime soon, because North Korean state-mandated history has a very different view of history that has come about only mostly since the 1990s, and makes it very unlikely that we're going to get a lot of useful data out of Pyongyang in the near future. I'll talk more about that later if you're interested. There may have been a kind of a sub-state polity called Joseon at this time. In fact, I personally am betting that something, maybe a chiefdom, that the Chinese referred to as Joseon probably existed somewhere in this area, and that Yan's expansion affected it and probably caused it to withdraw down into this area. There was, in fact, a conquest state called Joseon, which I'll talk about in a moment. It was established around sometime in the late 190s BC, but I don't think we can conclusively speak of a Joseon state existing prior to this. And I'll say a little bit more about that at the lecture tomorrow, I think. Now, this brings us to the second phase. I'm doing okay with time, I think. And this is characterized, again, by the rise of indigenous states and relations with their relations with neighboring states and peoples, primarily Chinese, but also nomadic peoples who lay farther to the north. And the first of these to appear, the earliest state-level polity that we can currently confirm archaeologically and historically, is the state of Puyo. And you can see that Puyo is labeled up here, and it's placed here at Nong'an. This is wrong. This is a very old view that turned out to be absolutely wrong. Puyo was located over here, only a few inches away on this map, but it's a very significant difference in real space. And this state arose probably around the end of the 3rd century BC, maybe slightly later. It didn't just immediately appear, it developed. And it appeared on the Songhua River. This is the Songhua River here in central Manchuria. Now, although this the state did not extend as far south as the Korean Peninsula proper, it only occupied this, maybe it probably came to about this far south and occupied this area here. Nevertheless, within Korean history, we still tend to talk about it as a Korean state because, well, first of all, some elements of its culture seem to appear also in later Korean culture. That is the culture of peninsular peoples, but also two of the later three kingdoms, namely Goguryeo and Baekje, would claim that they derived their political and cultural legitimacy directly from Puyo, not only from Puyo, but the Puyo ruling house. So I think it makes some sense to look at Puyo culture and as a potential influence on later Korean culture, and also since I did my doctoral dissertation on Puyo, so I'm predisposed to talk more about that than some others might be. But let me I'll move on to this slide. This is the site of the Puyo capital here in central Manchuria. Now, the state of Puyo developed out of the local Bronze Age culture on the Songhua River Valley as a result of increased interaction with the Chinese Yan state, which I mentioned before, but also with these nomadic pastoralists who lay to the west of Puyo. And archaeological finds illustrate this very, very nicely. In fact, Puyo material culture it looks like an indigenous, first of all, it contains an indigenous tradition, elements of mostly its pottery traditions, ways of burial, and so forth. continue on from the Bronze Age before that. But there also are these imports of luxury items. And among these, we have mirrors from Han China. Remember the TLV mirrors, things that were like that appear here for the first time. And also belt hooks of the same style. Oh, we saw one this morning, which was a peninsular belt hook, but there are these Chinese style. They're slightly different, but they serve the same functions. And we do start to see these in the early Puyo capital, which indicates relations with Han China. And we also see these luxury and utilitarian items, like bronze plaques with animal motifs and these iron kettles, which are more part of a nomadic tradition of the grasslands to the west. And in fact, we see they're essentially exactly the same things. These are imports. And we find them in not only in, we don't know of any royal burials of Puyo, but we do know of some elite burials. And this is where we find these things. Other conspicuous items in the inventory include iron weapons and armor. This is what I was talking about before, and we have some complete suits of armor, very well preserved, and the horse, both of which appear to have been introduced from the steppe rather than from China. So some of these views of history that really emphasize China's input to Korean history are skewed by the fact that we simply know more about Chinese culture and can identify it more readily. But this is a good illustration that this nomadic culture up to the north had a very serious influence as well. Now, the archaeological record shows that Puyo was a strong centralized state with a very distinct regional character, and probably the most representative, the single most representative symbol of Puyo identity that survives in archaeological context is this gilt bronze face mask. These are two examples. There's probably about seven or eight that have been seven or eight masks of this type that have been uncovered in some small linchpins that have miniature versions of these. This is interesting, too, and I want to point out something more about these. These are very nicely crafted. They have little indents in the ears, what possibly pierced ears. You can see this one a little better. This ear is not actually pointed. It's broken off, so it looks that way. You can see this. The teeth are shown as well as the tongue, and this appears to be indicate a beard. And up at the top, it looks like a topknot, which is something that we associate with later Korean culture. Is that a top knot? I don't know. I can't think of anything else it might be except possibly a cap, but it doesn't look like one. This is supposed to indicate hair. I think there was a top knot on this one, but it had broken off. Something more on these. We don't know if these are meant to represent a deity. Maybe the founder of Puyo is possible, or if they were individual people. They seem too small to have been death masks. They're only about this big. And we find them even smaller in much later periods. Anyway, we also find that the iron weapons of Puyo, and especially the armor, exerted a very strong influence on the corresponding weapons and armor that we find later associated with the southern peninsular states and also with Japan, and in particular the iron helmets, a very diagnostic type of artifact that we find. And it's a very peculiar type of construction. It's a multi-piece iron helmet, but you can trace its development from Puyo. The earliest we can find it is in Puyo. It may have had a predecessor farther to the west, but we find in the peninsula, especially with later Koguryo, Kaya, which is another entity we'll talk about, and even into Japan, you can see a steady development all the way from Puyo. And ultimately, they probably do have nomadic origins. Now, the weapons and armor are also interesting because they seem to represent Puyo as a strong military force. And this stands in contradiction to the characterization that we usually will come across today that tends to depict Puyo as peace-loving people who are non-threatening. They don't like to cause trouble. Someone who has studied Puyo, I disagree with this. I think that they certainly had the potential to cause trouble, especially in their earlier periods, and they were a force to be reckoned with. Now, besides the archaeological record, we can now begin to make use of historical sources. for information on Korean culture. It becomes a little more comfortable now because you have the written word. Almost always from a Chinese perspective, which is a drawback because we don't have a lot of survivals from the peninsular states. They did leave records and some fragments survive. But most of what we have, most of the really valuable information comes from Chinese observers. And I want to mention something, and I'll probably say something about this again tomorrow, but a very interesting thing happened in the mid part of the 3rd century, and that is a Chinese expedition from the state of Wei marched against Goguryeo and basically kicked the crap out of it. It was a very devastating attack launched against Goguryeo in 244, 245. And what they did was they dispatched a general to chase the Goguryeo king. And they chased him all around the peninsula. I mean, it must have gone on for months. They never caught him, as far as I can tell. The Chinese never bragged about having caught him, so I assume that they lost him. But in the course of this chase, they went through all of these different territories of people, and they started writing down notes about what they saw, and they were asking people about their culture. And so when you look at the these people called Ye or Okcho or Puyo or Ilo, there's a few other people who are treated in this and in a 3rd century Chinese source. This is where the information comes from, firsthand. And towards the end of the 3rd century, one of the Chinese dynastic histories called Sanguo Zhi, which means Chronicle of the Three Kingdoms of China, not of Korea. And all of this is in a book called the Dongyijuan, which means the sort of like the account of the Eastern barbarians. And basically, it almost reads as an anthropological report of all these different peoples. And what these observers were looking for is little quaint customs, things where they differed significantly from the Chinese themselves, things that they thought were just odd or unusual, and they would write this down. And also they tried to do some comparison, how did these people relate to one another. And this is a very valuable resource today, so we are able to know something about the society of early Koreans. Yes?
What do you call those Chinese?
The Wei? Yes. Yeah, this was the... there were two dynasties called Wei. This is not the Wei that Professor Best was talking about this morning, which was actually not truly a Chinese state. The one he spoke of is actually a Xianbei, a nomadic state that had conquered North China and called itself Wei. This is a different Wei, which is one of China's three kingdoms, which when the Han Dynasty fell apart around 189 AD, here's the historian going again, the Han Dynasty broke up into three, and there were three kingdoms, and Wei was the northernmost one, and this is the one that basically got Manchuria at that time, or I say it didn't get Manchuria, it got the Liaodong area of Manchuria, and brought it into contact, physical contact with the peninsula. Now, the account of Puyo in the Sanguo Zhi, the chronicle I just mentioned, mentions a few interesting things about its culture. And this is where we first start looking at things that we can almost recognize as being Korean. They're not exclusively Korean, but these are things that we can almost catch today when we consider Korean society. Some of them, not entirely. Historically, we can see totemism appears to have been something important. And when we consider that what many people refer to as shamanism still exists in Korea and existed much in a much bigger way a century ago than it does today. But totemism is something that is involved, especially deer, the deer totem. But in Puyo, they named officials after certain animals, and they named them ka. Ka just means sort of minister. So they had the horse ka, the cow ka, the dog ka. And some people say that this is emblematic of totemism, that they associated with these animals. Maybe that's true, or maybe that, you know, that just happened to be a neat way of naming people. But in any case, we do have this, and these are the Ka ranks, and we also see these later in Goguryeo. There's also this attention to ritual that we see in Puyo. The Chinese were very, very impressed with Puyo. They said that these people are fairly civilized, which is, you know, coming from them, that's saying quite a lot, because they for some of the others, they were really interested in their backward ways and sort of tended to see them as barbaric. But the Puyo they saw as being highly refined, and said that, well, they have these ceremonies, they worship heaven at the appropriate month, and so forth and so on. And what they were really referring to is the harvest ceremony, which was shared among all of the communities of the Korean Peninsula. They also like to party. There's talking about them loving to sing, and they dance at all hours of the night. This is something, if you've been to Korea, you can still see today and participate in, if you wish. Not everybody engages in this, but I think many Americans who go there remark on, people like to have a good time. And singing, if you've ever been to a Korean norebang, which is kind of a karaoke house, then you can understand this. More about that later. Two more items I'd like to bring up with regard to Puyo. One is that they liked white clothing. And this is something, I don't know if there's any connection with this, because we see that Kogryo and Baekje had very colorful clothing, but Puyo people like to adorn themselves with white clothing. And this is something that we associate much later with the Joseon period of Korean history. And when I say Joseon, I mean a much later state that began in the 14th century and ended in 1910. And you can still see people today wearing the white clothing. Also, the last thing I want to mention is that jealousy among women was probably the most despised thing in Puyo society, according to the Chinese. And they had this horrible punishment for a jealous woman basically would be killed and have her body exposed on this mountain to this. Remember the mountain I showed you before? Some people think it might have been this place. I don't think so. I think it was probably a little farther to the south. But they would expose her body there until it had rotted, and then her family could only reclaim her body for burial if they paid a ransom of I think, cattle. Very harsh. So you get the idea that they really did not like jealous. Yeah. I don't know. No, we don't know of any particular reason, and the Chinese did not offer one. They simply say they liked it. And we don't know enough about Puyo culture or cosmology or religion to associate that with anything in particular. It seems just to have been a custom. I wish I could tell you, because that's one of the things that I sort of questioned myself when I was doing my my field research in China. So, one more thing about it had been assumed, I think in the early part of the 20th century, by one Korean scholar, that the idea that Puyo people disliked jealous women might have pointed to polygamy, that men had more than one wife, and that, this is one reason that why you might have had jealousy among women. And interestingly enough, in the 1980s and 90s, it turns out that in the formative period of Puyo culture, we see males buried very often with two females. He may have had it, he may have hit that one on the head. Now, already with Puyo, as I mentioned, we start to find elements that would come to be associated with later Korean culture. Although, again, we can't say that there is a direct connection. It may not be quite as direct as it seems when we look at it from this level. Now, let me move on away from Puyo, reluctantly, but moving a little bit towards the south and to the peninsula proper, we can begin to discuss state formation and state-level polities from the beginning of the 2nd century B.C., say the 190s B.C. Now, although the state of Puyo had appeared in central Manchuria by the end of the 3rd century, there is no firm evidence, again, that any state-level polity existed in southern Manchuria or the Korean peninsula at that time. Instead, archaeological evidence suggests that probably there were a number of chiefdom societies at this time, and we do see this reflected in mortuary analysis and archaeology. And the difference between a chiefdom and a state really is thought to be that a chiefdom is limited. It can only reach a chiefdom organization can only sustain a certain size of population before it has to split. And a state theoretically can grow indefinitely. It just has sort of a top-down replicable pyramid type of organization that has gone way beyond the kinship connections that define the way lower orders of complex society are put together. And we think that some of the earliest chiefdoms probably occupied only a single drainage system at best. So you have a river here, and whatever its drainage system was, this one's a bad example because this is huge, but some of the smaller drainage systems are probably very, very small. One valley or maybe two. Now, the first state-level polity that appears on the Korean Peninsula, and there are those who disagree with me, but I maintain that it was actually a conquest state. That is, it was not one that developed indigenously, but it was one that was imposed from outside. And that is a state or a polity of Chosin. Again, there was a state called Chosin that was established around 194 BC by a man called Wei Man, sometimes called Weiman in Korean, who is said to have been a man of the Chinese Yan state. There were some upheavals in the early 190s after the Han Empire had formed, and the Yan state became just one component of the Han Empire. And the king of Yan had a falling out with the emperor of Han, or more likely with his wife after the emperor died, and so he fled to the Xiongnu, and people just started leaving wholesale out of the Yan area. And one of them, Wei Man, fled to this area here, and it is said that he basically took over the Chosin state that had already existed there, but it's likely that this was just a chiefdom and that he imposed a state organization on this level that previously had been a chiefdom. But he did, this was a state, and it functioned as one. I'll say a little bit more about Wei Man in the lecture tomorrow. Here it's probably useful to note that certain elements of Chinese culture had been directly implanted in peninsular lands by the first half of the 2nd century BC. The extent of Wei Man's state probably encompassed maybe the drainage systems of the Taedong and the Cheryong rivers. The Taedong river is right here. The Cheryong you can't see, but it runs right here. So his state probably was located right here. Maybe included this area as well, but certainly here. Yeah. And it was centered probably on modern Pyongyang, which is right here. And the influence of the imported culture was strongest, of course, in the area around the capital, but it did extend to lesser degrees outside of that central area. It was quite weak. The best archaeological evidence that we have for the presence of this state right now are iron implements and the scattered distribution of Yan coins. And you can see three examples of them. These are from my own collection of things I got in northeast China. These are found around this area, even up to the Yalu Valley and around this area, about the same area that Wei Man's Chosin state is thought to have existed. We tend to find these, but they appear mostly in caches or in tombs, which tells us that these were probably regarded as luxury items more than as, you know, they're probably curiosities. They weren't used as currency. At least in the broad scheme, it is possible that the brokers who were based at Pyongyang, who were part of Wei Man's state, they themselves might have connected themselves with the monetary system of Yan, because one of the reasons that this state existed for as long as it did, close to a century, is that it monopolized trade between all these surrounding peoples in Han China. And this is what allowed Wei Man to maintain the state for a while, but after the Chinese got a little upset with him for blocking certain people who wanted access to Han, they decided to move against him, and more on that in a moment. Now, since that Wei Man did use his state as sort of a trade conduit between Han China and then the indigenous peoples in the surrounding area, we can expect that there were other luxury items or even utilitarian items that found their way by trade into the indigenous communities, thereby contributing to their cultural development. And we can't map this exactly because we just don't have enough archaeological information from North Korea. But a lot of the things that we find that date to this period that clearly came from Han China probably got out into these areas by way of the Wei Man Chosun state. The Chinese influence was considerably strengthened after 108 BC because in that year the emperor of the Han dynasty destroyed. He sent his armies against Wei Man state here. And he incorporated this entire state as a commandery, which is sort of a military prefecture of the Han dynasty. And this whole area became directly administered under the Han dynasty. And this is what people mean when they talk about a Chinese outpost in on the Korean Peninsula. And this lived, this lasted for a long time until around 313, 315 AD, this Lilang commandery persisted. The Pyongyang region, therefore, became a hub for interregional trade, interregional trade between Han China and the various peoples to the east, who were located in Manchuria, Korea, and even in the western parts of Japan. And you remember the mirrors that we saw, the TLV mirrors that were distributed, were almost certainly distributed out of the commandery called Lelang, which is, this is one way of writing it here. Another way is L-E-L-A-N-G. And this Chinese presence had profound consequences for the development of indigenous cultures, though, again, Chinese influence would become much more significant in the 4th century A.D., and I'll be talking about that shortly. Now, the next state that appears is the state of Koguryo, and that appeared actually in this area, right about here, in fact, in this valley. And it is the first indigenous state that ever occupied a portion of the Korean Peninsula. It rapidly expanded into this area here as well. And it first appears in historical records from around the 1st century BC, and it had developed into a state-level polity by the end of the 1st century AD. So we see a long process of development. The spatial extent of early Koguryo was probably limited to the Hun River Basin. This is Tungja River. It hasn't been called Tungja River for about 100 years. It's now called the Hun River. But it originated in this area and then rapidly expanded. I should point out that one of the ways in which Koguryo developed into a state level of complexity is because immediately after the Han Dynasty had conquered Chosun and established that commandery here, it also established three other commanderies around it, but these didn't last very long because local resistance